we think it's in France, as a young man, that Charles contracted the syphilis that was to really sort of plague the rest of his life. And on his restoration of the monarchy in 1660, when he becomes king, he led a court of, pretty wild abandon, pretty debauched and licentious court. He had 14 illegitimate children with his various mistresses, no legitimate children at all. Presumably, Catherine and Brigantia, his wife, was not able to bear children. It's entirely possible, of course, that she wasn't able to bear children because of the syphilis that she contracted from her husband. But he had dozens and dozens of mistresses. The Earl of Rochester famously said of his mistresses, of Charles I, "His sceptre and his prick are of equal length. She who plays with one commands the other." So anyway. Charles II, this is a meaning from him in his early 50s here. He had a lot of kidney problems and ulcers on his leg, both typical symptoms of the pox. And in 1685, at the age of 54, he ate a couple of goose eggs, which presumably were off because he had terrible diarrhea, which left him dehydrated. Nowadays, of course, if you have diarrhea, dehydrated, something like that, the doctors will just put you on some fluids and you'll be right as rain, of course, within a few hours, actually. This didn't happen to Charles II. They gave him a little glass of sweet sherry. He became delirious and he collapsed unconscious on the floor. And at this point, poor, unfortunate Charles becomes the subject of the doctor's attention. 12 of them. And over the next 5 days, oh, what this poor man went through. They bled him. So they cut his veins and let out prodigious quantities of blood. They shaved his head. They cupped him. They blistered him with hot iron. So they put hot irons on his feet to raise blisters to hope that the disease would leave the man that way. Over the course of 5 days, 58 different treatments are listed as being given to the king. They gave poultices on his skin. They gave him enemas. They gave him emetics to make him sick. His health got worse and worse and worse. There is no record of him complaining at all about this. In fact, he actually apologized to his courtiers for taking so long to die. His health got progressively worse, and in the end, his poor kidneys, which are never great, as I said in the first place, gave up, strangled by the syphilis and the dehydration. And on the 6th of February, 1685, at the age of 56, he died. And he was interred in Westminster Abbey, where he remains to this very day. Let's talk a little bit about mental illness, because there are lots of mental illness stories to tell in royalty. This is King Henry VI. Now, at his very first state opening of Parliament, King Henry VI in 14... At his very first state opening of Parliament, King Henry VI cried the entire way through the ceremony. He does have a very good excuse, though, because he was only 3 years old at the time. He'd already been king for over 2 years. He was king at 6 months, the youngest monarch we've ever had. He possibly inherited his mental instability from his mother, Catherine de Valois, and it ran in her family. Her grandfather, Charles VI of France, had some pretty psychotic episodes. In fact, at one point, he murdered two of his courtiers in front of the court in one of these butcherous, barbaric, psychotic episodes. Now, for Henry, our king, didn't take this form. In fact, quite the opposite. This kept coming back through his life, but the worst outbreak occurred when he was 32. And for 18 months, he sat still, essentially, and didn't move. He lost his memory. he lost his capacity for speech. He couldn't even lift his head up without help. He didn't recognize his wife. He didn't recognize his children. He had essentially had a total mental breakdown. And of course, this is not great in a king, because at the time, the body of the king and the health of the kingdom were intertwined. A strong and healthy king is required for a strong and healthy kingdom. And even when he was well, and he had, you know, periods when he was well, Henry VI wasn't that interested in fighting. He was interested in prayer and education. He founded Eton School. He founded King's College, Cambridge. And in the end, he was deposed during what we call the Wars of the Roses by his cousin, who became Edward IV. And he was imprisoned in the Tower of London, where on the 21st of May, 1471, he was murdered. The second of the two kings to be murdered in the Tower of London. He's buried in St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle. He almost became a saint, actually. Henry VII, when he came to the throne, really revered Henry VI and apparently asked the Pope if he could have Henry VI canonized. And the Pope said yes. And he told him how much it was going to cost. And Henry VII said, well, yeah, I think we'll leave it. It's far too much. Henry VII, a famously stingy king. Anyway, this is James I, who came to the throne in 1603 here in England on the death of Elizabeth I that we talked about earlier. Now, James I's coming into the world, even before he was born, things are pretty traumatic. His mother, Mary Queen of Scots, saw her possibly lover, possibly friend, David Rizzio, murdered. So David Rizzio is murdered by by Mary Queen of Scots' husband, Lord Darnley, stabbed to death whilst he was hanging on to Mary Queen of Scots' skirt. A pretty traumatic occasion. But eventually James I becomes King First of Scotland. His homosexuality seems to be fairly well known, fairly well accepted at court. But he did do his regnal duty. So even though he might not have been first choice, he did marry Anne of Denmark. And there seems to be some tenderness between them. So perhaps he was genuinely bisexual. But they had numerous children, including Prince Henry, who we talked about earlier, one of the boys that died before he got to be king. And as I say, in 1603, when Elizabeth I dies, James I comes to the throne of England. He's a pretty insalubrious character, James I. He picked his nose in public, in court. He would slobber all over his boyfriends in front of everybody in court. He did a lot of slobbering, James I. His tongue was too big for his mouth. And so he would dribble a lot and food would fall out of his mouth when he ate. He was uncouth, he was foul-mouthed, so he wasn't a particularly attractive character. But as he moved into middle age, his mental capacity failed him. Perhaps the same ailment that Henry VI had, perhaps early on senility, not quite sure. But he grew progressively frail and progressively vacant. His chief lover, George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, said, I know just the thing, I have this magic powder that will cure the king. And he gave it to him, and his fingernails and his toenails turned black and dropped off. So it's probably arsenic. We don't think he was trying to kill the king. We think he was genuinely trying to help, believing that the arsenic would cure him, but he didn't do any help. And Pneumonia. Pneumonia is often called the old man's friend. The old man's friend, pneumonia. Because as the oxygen levels in the blood reduce, the sufferer sort of lapses into unconsciousness and slips away quietly in their sleep. And this appears to be what happened to King James I. And he too was buried in Westminster Abbey. Although, for many years, nobody was absolutely sure where. James I had built this fantastic tomb for his mother, Mary Queen of Scots, in the Abbey, and for Queen Elizabeth I, but not one for himself. And for years and years, it became this bit of thing. Whatever happened to the body of James I. Nobody knew where it had gone. They knew it was in the Abbey somewhere, but couldn't nobody knew where it